This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, I'm talking to Oliver Radcliffe about his new memoir, Frighten the Horses. It's nice to meet you, Oliver. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, David. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, well, I'm really glad to have you here. You know, I admire anyone who can write a memoir because it is just in the first instance, the level of risk and bravery that it takes to say things to the world in a book, that in many cases, you know, if I sort of contrast to a lot of fiction writers, you know, fiction writers are, it's all in direction. Mm-hmm. And memoir is absolutely direct, even though you're telling a story and it's a narrative. So I have to compliment you on that.
Thank you.
In the first instance. And then kind of maybe explore that a little bit, because I just want to know maybe if how that relates to how you see yourself in the world, because in your story, you know, how you see yourself is a very complex
evolution.
Yes.
Yes.
And that you don't, you know, in a sense, don't know yourself, so that the book itself is about learning who you are.
Yes, it is.
And being able to go from that kind of I don't want to say private so much as kind of personal, you know, the personal self to the public self.
Yeah.
Seems to me almost radical.
Yes, I mean, it is radical because the journey of the book is somebody who goes from a state of complete deep denial into somebody who figures out how to live out loud the truth of who they are. Because when the book opens, I am identifying as a heterosexual female. And when the book ends, I am identifying as a queer trans man. So the journey of the narrative of the book itself is about somebody rising up out of denial. But then once the book is finished and has made its way into the hands of an agent and an editor, then the sort of physical reality of the book going out into the world is this sort of second level of coming out. You know, I've been through the process of coming out to my friends, my family, and my children, and my parents, my ex-husband, and now it's really sort of coming out in a very public way. So there's been a fair amount of psychological preparation for that, I have to say.
Right. Well, and not everyone is either prepared for or equipped to do that. So it does take a certain, I mean, not only the willingness, but the ability to withstand that level of examination and intrusion.
Yeah. And I think it takes a level of having reached a place where it really doesn't matter to me anymore. Having reached a place during this whole process where I can stomach and stand other people's opinions if they're negative. That my skin is now so thick that it is a little bit water off a duck's back. And, you know, because I'm older, because I came out later, because I did have a great amount of support from my friends and family, you know, I'm really in a relatively safe position to put stuff like this out into the world. And I think that more stories like this do need to go out into the world because there is a massive lack of understanding around these issues.
Well, that is absolutely true. As you know, I think I mentioned to you before we started recording is that I have some personal experience, not in my family, and the complexity and the challenges for the person who's going through it are matched by the complexity and challenges of the people around the person.
Yes.
And it's not everyone who's going through what you went through has the wherewithal or the desire to share that.
Yes.
Widely.
Yeah.
Because it is so challenging.
It's challenging and it makes a lot of people very vulnerable.
Well, and it also even, you know, I was thinking about this today. I was reading an article by a guy who is a an editor, a publishing editor who's Black, mm-hmm. and he talked about the inadvertent microaggressions of his colleagues,
yeah,
who make assumptions,
yeah,
sometimes even say things that were that reveal a racism,
yeah,
that is so embedded mm-hmm. that the speaker of the racist comment has no intention of being,
yeah,
and doesn't even realize that they are playing that narrative.
Yeah.
And they're playing that role. And that must happen to you
all the time.
As first of all, as a gay person,
yeah,
absolutely. As a trans person, but also the confusion that it causes people when they discover that you are a man who once was a woman. And who then was, you know, that your journey is very,
yeah,
the number of personae,
yeah,
you've had,
yes,
is confusing,
yes,
to the people around you, so that even if they don't intend to be insulting or pain or cause you harm or cause, yeah, you pain, they can.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have learned to try and be generous first. And to assume that anything that anybody says that's sort of slightly off center is usually done out of ignorance. And I am very aware that everybody is sort of running to catch up at the moment. You know, we really are right in the middle of this huge movement of trans awareness. And of course, with that huge new movement of trans awareness comes the backlash. Yeah. And a lot of people feel like they're kind of caught in a small boat in a very large choppy sea, trying to work out which way is up and what it's all about and how it's working. And I think that people are, you know, because of so much literature that's been published recently, and particularly in 2020, and the work that's been done to bring people to understand that there's not just racism, you can't just not be racist, you have to be anti-racist. And I think that this same sort of situation is happening with trans people now, is it's not enough just to say, yes, I accept trans people. You have to really start to investigate the ways in which you have this innate bias towards trans people. And
It's cultural,
yeah,
because it's not just a bias against trans people, even though I think there is something there, that the trans person upsets our sense of stability.
Yeah, very much
and
so.
We have a set of defined roles.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like, it's not good enough to be a feminist mm-hmm. if you don't actually, you know, if you just speak the language, mm-hmm. it's easy to do, mm-hmm. but you have to change your behavior.
Yes.
But, and I don't think that we have fully even grappled with that that change, which goes back maybe 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
Racism, obviously we've had hundreds of years to
yeah.
deal with. But in the gender and sexuality parts of our beings mm-hmm. and our cultural mm-hmm. abilities to understand ourselves, it's way scarier, I
yeah.
think.
And I think that the gender issues for a lot of people are very new. And so playing catch up now is incredibly important, which is why when people like Roxane Gay are willing to platform people like myself, you know, this is the best thing that we can hope for. Because the more stories that get out there, the more people are going to begin to understand. And you know, you can tell relatively quickly who is saying something because they genuinely don't understand, and they really want to learn, and they really want to get it right. They just, you know, they're grappling with this stuff, and who is just not okay with it. And so you learn to kind of read the room with people very, very quickly, and you learn, you know, every time I go out, because I live, you know, out in the suburbs, I'm in Connecticut, I'm very close to where you are. You know, every time I go out, a lot of the time people just read me as a cis man because I pass now, which makes it very easy. But if I'm in a group of people where some people do know that I'm trans and somebody becomes aware of it, you know, I'm constantly having to be on the lookout as to whether they may be hostile, whether they are going to be okay with it, how they're going to read it, what they're going to say, how much they're going to understand. You know, it's a constant navigation while I'm out in public, trying to sort of figure out where the danger might lie, as it were.
Yeah, and I think about that in terms of my child, and worrying about the dangers that face people who are trans. Mm. I mean, the dangers that face people who are gay, because there is so much homophobia, and there's certainly a lot of transphobia from people who are physically violent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we're fortunate to live in Connecticut, which is a fairly open,
liberal state.
Liberal, but not, you know, not
across the board.
It's not like being in New York.
Yeah.
When you go, you talked about that in your book, and I thought that was, you know, for anyone who grew up around the suburbs of New York, whether it's Connecticut, Long Island, or New Jersey, we all have the same feeling about New York City, which is that that's where culture is at its most advanced and open for us. So that, and I know that in the Midwest, Minneapolis has the same attraction, that if you are gay or trans growing up in any place in the Midwest, you're going to go to Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And probably LA and San Francisco have the same draw that it's where you can feel safe.
Yeah.
And also among people who understand you and who are participants in the same cultural milieu.
Yeah. And it's really interesting how my identity and my feelings about my identity shift depending on my location. Because I'm always a little bit on edge here in Connecticut because I am a fish out of water and I am relatively unique and unusual. And, you know, not in a way that makes me feel comfortable. And I go to New York, and the minute I arrive in New York, I just feel normal. I feel invisible. I just feel part of this huge sea of...
No, I think it's the invisibility.
Yes, the invisibility, exactly.
Because there's so much diversity of... I mean,
nobody stands out.
Although some people do.
Well, you've got to be pretty extreme to stand out, and I'm not that extreme.
There are some people who do stand out, but still they will be accepted there.
Because that's what you expect in New York.
Yeah, and it also, I suppose, it varies by neighborhood.
Yes.
There are some places in New York, like Staten Island, where you would not feel quite as comfortable. But, you know, you go to the Village, go to Lower East Side.
But you see, I think this is what makes the story that I've written about in the book, it's what gives it its sort of unique edge, is that normally you would think that if you're writing a story about a trans person, you know, they may have spent their childhood in a small town and been through that experience of growing up, understanding that they're queer or trans and not being able to do anything about it because they're in this sort of small town situation. And then they move to a big city and then they find their people and they come out and they transition. And, you know, that's the kind of narrative that people are more familiar with. Whereas my narrative is, I was in so much denial about my, but growing up in the 1980s in England, I was in so much denial about my identity. I had no idea I was trans. I didn't even know that trans was a thing you could be. And when I started to come out first as gay, and then 6 or 7 years later, I started to transition. I did it all in the suburbs. So, you know, although I found these pockets of community and friendships and these sort of weekends away in New York, the large part of my coming out and my transition was done in this relatively wealthy, white, heterosexual suburb in Connecticut, which is kind of a weird place to do what I did.
Right. Well, and in your particular case, unlike many, you had children.
Yes.
And you have four children, which is amazing. Children. Right?
Yes.
And being a parent, I have three, and I know how hard that is.
Yeah.
And you've been mostly a single parent, which makes it even harder.
Yeah.
But I think that, I mean, it's partly this situation that you were in. You just, you know, you could put it as, you could sort of chalk it up to, though, you had four kids, you know,
you're going to be. What else are we going to do? Exactly.
Right. Raising four children in New York or any other city.
Yeah, no, really definitely not. Yeah.
So
not unless you're a bazillionaire.
Right. I always noticed when I was, you know, when our kids were young, that we would meet people and they had been on this sort of journey that when they lived in New York, mm-hmm. they had a kid, the baby, they could figure it out, sleep in a closet. Once mm-hmm. they had a second kid, they were moving to Westchester. Mm-hmm. And when they had the third kid, they moved to Connecticut.
Yes, exactly. And that's pretty much it, yeah.
So, but, you know, it is also a sort of underlying theme in your book, in your life story, is that you've started in one place and ended up in another geographically.
Yeah.
You're, not only are you a formerly gay woman, formerly heterosexual woman, but you're formerly a, you know, someone who grew up in England.
Yes.
I mean, well, you did grow up in England, but you're formerly yeah. from there.
Yes. Yeah.
And so you have all the, it's almost like you've shed skins repeatedly to get where you are.
Yeah. And I shed skins to get where I am, and then discovered finally at the end of that journey that I had become so complete and whole in myself as a person that really I can sort of go anywhere and do anything and it all kind of feels okay now. I think for a long time I did think that I felt like I was looking for something. I felt that I didn't belong to anything that I had tried to belong to, and that if I found this place or this group or a person or something, that I would feel like I belonged. And along that journey, what I actually discovered was that I just needed to figure out who I was. And, you know, that kind of sounds like a cliche because, you know, that's what all the memes tell us, you know, just be who you are. But for someone like me, trying to be who I was really complicated because I had built myself up in so many layers of what I thought I was supposed to be. It was very hard to, you know, slough all that off and find out what was going on underneath. But what is, you know, what is nice now is that I feel this incredible freedom that, you know, I'm still living here in the suburbs. I could move to New York. I could move back to England. I could move to Nashville, wherever, Italy, and I would still feel like a whole person. And that's still, the novelty of that still hasn't worn off.
Right. Well, yeah, because it's still fairly new for you.
Yeah,
you're still, you know, you're like a child in that sense.
I am. I'm an adolescent. Yeah. Right. I'm a 53-year-old adolescent. Right. Adolescent trans person.
Right. Well, you're as a kind of young man.
Yeah.
Growing into being.
Yeah.
You know, the male that you want to be.
Yeah.
And you know, even I guess, you know, biological males also have all, we've all gone through those, mm-hmm. And women too, go, you know, mm-hmm. all of us grow up. So you're yeah. having a new phase of growing up.
Yes.
Or growing into, which is kind of cool. Everybody gets to do that.
Well, I kind of had three adolescences in a sense. I had the first one, obviously, when I was actually an adolescent. And then I had a second adolescence when I came out as a lesbian. And that was probably the most heightened, because moving from a straight identity into a queer identity for me was like the biggest step, because that was the thing that had been so terrifying to me. I was closeted all my life because I was absolutely certain that if I identified as queer, I would be rejected by everybody. And back in the 1980s, I almost certainly would have been. Luckily, by the time I finally came out, you know, the world had moved on, as had all my friends and family, and it wasn't so hard. But from an emotional perspective, it felt huge. It felt absolutely terrifying and utterly euphoric. And there was no point in about 2 years when I wasn't having some kind of overly heightened emotion or other. So it was kind of fun and crazy, but it was also pretty exhausting. And then 6 or 7 years later, when I finally transitioned, it actually didn't feel like quite such a big deal, because I felt like I'd kind of done most of the work by then. The transition was just like the final step. And it was just, okay. And that's why it comes quite near the end of the book, because really the work in a transition is the work that builds you up to that place. And the transition itself is sort of just part of the journey. And then after the transition, which I don't write about so much in the book because the book sort of comes to an end at that point, then it's just sort of figuring out what kind of person you are and what kind of man you want to be, or how, you know, how you want to configure this sort of newly trans identity. So it's not like this, you would think that the transition was the biggest part, because from the perspective of the outside world, it is certainly the biggest change.
Right.
But from my perspective, it didn't feel so much, because to me, it just felt like a sort of coming home into my own body.
Right. No, that is, I think that's really important, but it is from outside. This is the outsider question.
Yeah.
Sort of supportive outsider question. And that has to do with, you know, that when you transition from being a queer woman, you lose a whole, set of relationships and identities, you know, where there, sort of look at it this in the continuum, there are more heterosexuals, and you go to a small but really vibrant and accepting community of queer women and men.
Yeah.
And then you go to an even smaller community of trans people.
Yes.
And so you're, and you have to give, in a certain way, it's not that you give up any of those, but you do change the way you relate to.
Yes. And that's a really good question, because that was my fear. That was the thing that held me back from transitioning for so long. Because when I transitioned from presenting as a heterosexual woman to presenting as a queer woman, I felt like I'd found my people and I'd found my community. And suddenly I felt like I was home and I was surrounded by these people who I loved and who understood me and who felt like the people I'd been looking for all my life. And I was terrified that if I transitioned, I would lose that. Mm-hmm. And what actually happened instead was that instead of moving from a large community to a small community or to a smaller community, I actually just released myself from groups entirely. So by transitioning, I felt like I just stopped belonging to a group. And so therefore, not only was I not constrained by the kind of rules and parameters of that group, but also I could sort of go anywhere and be anything. Right. And so what I thought was going to be very isolating ended up being very liberating. And so, you know, when we talk about the trans community, Casey Plett has written a brilliant book on this called On Community. There were a lot of questions about what does trans community mean, and nobody in the trans community can really agree on what trans community means, because it is such a broad, there is such a broad set of identities that there's no real coherence there. You know, these are just people who are gender nonconforming, right? And so there are no rules, because that's kind of the point of trans, is that you're breaking all the rules. You're doing exactly what feels right and what works for you. And so now my friends are straight people and queer people and trans people and lesbians and gays and men and women, and I can sort of be friends with anybody, and it's extraordinarily liberating. I mean, I have straight male friends, I have queer female friends, I have trans femme friends, I have trans mask friends, non-binary friends. It's just, it's like I can sort of relate to anybody now, because everybody to whom I speak knows that some part of my experience is shared with some part of their experience.
Yeah.
Which is really fun.
Yeah. No, I think that's really good. I think that helps to overcome the idea that everything has to be about identity, and that, you know, that you create your identity is built around a community of similar people. I mean, we do that as human beings. I know that's sort of the tribal part of us.
Yeah.
But it is true. And I think it's sort of what's really interesting about the radical a breaking of norms that transgender people do, is that you are essentially reopening yourself and forcing other people to rethink all of their expectations.
Yes.
And I think that's, you know, it's sort of a, what you're, in one way, and I don't want to over-romanticize it, but it is a little bit like making your life your art, because artists do, that's what artists, great artists are not capable of following somebody else's guidance all the time. I mean, you learn how to paint, or you learn how to create sculpture, but when you are truly inspired, you do what the inspiration drives you to do.
Yeah.
And that can, that's true for writing as well. So, you know, the, which is why often artists are out on the edge and have a lot of trouble adapting to culture, and culture doesn't know what to do with them.
Yes. And it does sometimes feel like you're creating yourself from scratch. And again, this is a conversation that I have with one of my exes in the book, where she says, you know, you can't just pick and choose your identity like you're choosing, you know, clothes off a rack in a store. To which my, you know, because she said, you know, your identity is innate. And I'm like, yes, my identity is innate, but it's also not, it's not like off, it's not like, I can't just put on somebody else's suit and say, this is going to fit me now. You really do have to create it from scratch. And you sort of figure it out when you're trans. You go through this long period of, you know, what fits and what doesn't fit. And you try things on and they either feel like, oh my God, this is like your loveliest, oldest sweater. Or it's this kind of scratchy thing that's too tight and makes you feel uncomfortable. And there is this, you know, when we talk about adolescence, there is this period of trying to sort of figure out, not just with clothes, but with everything, with how you sit, with how you speak, with how, you know, what parts of your femininity you want to retain, what parts you want to give up, what parts of masculinity feel right for you, what parts of masculinity feel performative, all of these things. So you're just kind of like this awkward sort of gangly mess of genders that kind of clang together for a while until eventually you figure out, yeah, I want to keep this and I want to lose that, and this still works for me and that doesn't. And then you sort of finally become somebody who doesn't have to think about it anymore. And that's, to me, the kind of, if you could identify an endpoint of a transition, which really you can't, but if you were to, it would be once you reach that point where you don't have to think about who you are and how you behave and what you say and how you present, because that is something that takes up 98% of your energy prior to transition.
Right. Sort of clearly a relief, but I think you're right. And you don't stop changing. You've reached that threshold point where you are who you are. You feel comfortable, as you would put it, comfortable in your own skin. Yeah. And once you're there, it doesn't mean you have to stop, you know, exploring or changing, and you will, because, and I think in your case, what you'll do is, I mean, you'll keep changing.
Yes. Yes. It was somebody, I can't remember who it was, who said that, age is the fourth gender, because it kind of is, you know, I mean, I am definitely going to keep changing as I get older, and my age is going to affect my gender as much as anything else might.
Well, and I can say that as an older person.
Yes.
Which you don't have any clue about until you reach those points, which is true for most experiences. You know, women will tell you that unless you get pregnant, you have no idea what it feels like, and men can never. Mm-hmm. But there are other things that no one can recognize until you get there.
Yeah.
And clearly, and for you, maybe even more complicated because you're on a kind of individualistic path. Mm. There may not be a template.
No, exactly. There. It's going to be very interesting to see what I turn into.
Right.
As I move out of middle age into old age.
But it makes it kind of fun.
It totally does.
I don't think we can finish without talking a little bit about your kids. I thought, you know, it was, I think for you, really, you're lucky that you did this with kids in the first place, but also that those kids were so brilliant in helping guide you into how to deal with them and also how they could deal with you.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, you know, you get some whether it's you doing it or whether they were doing it or it's a combination of both, it's pretty amazing. And I loved the moment near the end of the book when you're, you know, in a diner with all four of them and they tell you, and I assume you did not know this, that you were known in the amongst the kids as the mom dad.
I know. That was just wonderful.
That was fantastic.
But it's so perfect because, you know, out of the mouth of babes, they do, you know, they have just come out with such gems. And, you know, it's not that it's been easy for them because it hasn't, but their ability to sort of roll with the punches and to figure things out and to enlighten me about what we're all going through. I mean, my daughters were the ones who kind of called my transness first, even almost before I did, because they could just see it happening. And they'd grown up, unlike me, they grew up with queerness all around them. And they grew up with the vocabulary and they grew up with the visibility. And so, you know, I wouldn't quite say it was normal, but it was an available option. So when they saw the changes that I was going through before I had even started transitioning, when I was really, I suppose, what we would call now social transitioning, but hadn't quite admitted that to myself, they clocked it because they recognize it because the visibility of the trans movement has made that recognizable to preteen kids, which is what they were at the time. And that's the joy about the books and the bookstores and the movies and the television shows and all of this and the TikToks and all the rest of it that these kids have access to, because it just isn't quite so weird or scary or unknown anymore.
Or restrictive.
Or restrictive.
Because it means also for them, they now know that they can define themselves. It doesn't mean that they're going to become trans.
But like my daughter said when she was three, and I said, you can be anything you want to be now. And she said, even a penguin? And I'm like, yep, even a penguin. If you want to be a penguin, right, you can be a penguin. But yeah, it's a much better environment now. We've got a long way to go. It's not perfect by any means, but it's better. No.
Well, and there's always a sense, as you know, culture is evolving, and I've had for a long time the sense that we were moving in a positive direction, and I still feel that we are, but I also feel, as we all do, I think right now, a little bit threatened. Yes. By some of the, the pushback, the sort of Dionysian versus Apollonian dynamic is in play, particularly now.
It
and
is.
That's a little scary, you know, the macro of world events where we want to believe that we can create a free and diverse and supportive community for the culture at large. But not everybody agrees with that.
No. And, you know, as we've seen, when we look at feminism and civil rights, all these civil rights movements, whether it's for women or black people or queer people or whatever, you know, progress gets made. The backlash comes, it's inevitable. We know it's going to happen. We knew it was going to happen. You have to ride through it. And you get out the other side somewhere different. And it's not over. It's never going to be over.
Yeah. It's the two steps forward, one step back.
It's the two steps forward and one step back. So the only option that you have is just to keep fighting and keep going and hope that it gets better and better for more and more people, and that it gradually becomes more socially unacceptable to be transphobic, and more crucially, that people understand what transphobia is. Because as you said at the beginning of this conversation, a lot of transphobia comes out in these microaggressions where people really don't understand that they're being transphobic. And the more that the awareness gets raised as to what transphobia actually is, the more people are going to learn what is okay and what's not, and how to make trans people feel more comfortable, more accepted, and more safe.
Which kind of relates to the title of your book.
It does. It does indeed.
is it British? It's a British saying, I
it
think.
It is, yeah.
Right? You can be anything you want, but just don't frighten the horses.
Yeah, it was Mrs. Patrick Campbell who said it about, she was asked, she was a British actor back in the 1920s, and she was asked by a journalist what she felt about a couple of gay people who were in the chorus of the play she was in. And she said, I don't mind what they do in private, as long as they don't do it in the streets and frighten the horses. And it was, it's become a very well-known phrase for, you know, keep it all out of sight, you know.
Exactly. Very British.
Yeah. And I was like, no, I don't think so, not anymore. We're bringing it out into the street and we're going to frighten the horses.
Exactly. Well, I really want to thank you for doing this, Oliver. It's been terrific. I love talking to you. I hope we can talk again.
It's been an absolute pleasure, David.
And wish you luck with the book too.
Thank you.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Oliver Radcliffe about Frighten the Horses, a memoir. And you can't see it, but it has a really terrific cover by another Oliver. So thanks for doing this.